Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And for the final time in 2024, it is Pollock and Thurston coming at you, the co-production of WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling. Hello, Brandon. How are you?
I'm good. It is starting to snow here in Western New York.
Is it?
What's it like there? How's the weather there?
We are experiencing a light rainfall today, which could change into snow by the end of tonight, possibly.
It is full-blown snow right now.
Wow. Well, I feel that it is strictly my my relationship on this show to you that I have become a passive follower of the Buffalo Bills. I have not watched a minute of football this year, but it seems like there was a massive win over the Detroit Lions. I mean, what's our temperature check on the Bills? Is it reflecting, you know, is it cause for celebration?
It's always guarded optimism. I mean, when you've been through what we've been through in 1990, 1991, 1992, and 1993, you never get too much hope. So, okay,
well, we are you are one step closer, I would say, at this juncture. We are going to be talking about all things ratings today. I can't wait. This is the proper way to end off the year with a grand debate about linear television numbers and streaming. And it all came together this past Saturday night. That's to come. That was going to be the lead, but leave it to the New York Times to drop on us a story this morning on our lap. We'll also be talking a little bit about some stories that were of significance this past year, maybe a little on the WWE holiday loop. I'm curious to get some of your thoughts as WWE goes into what is traditionally like their biggest week of the year for house shows. And we're also going to spend about 20 seconds on Tony Khan's media call from Tuesday promoting ROH Final Battle. That typically these calls I go through and I isolate like 2 to 3 clips. I asked you, Brandon.
Asked me this morning. I said, no, I don't think so.
I'm not even trying to be sarcastic and snarky like I usually am. There was nothing for me to take from any of this. Like there was nothing.
It was a little shorter than usual. Not much, but it was like 48 minutes instead of like an hour or a couple of minutes more than an hour as it usually is. They did mention that, you know, they're doing another call soon because of World's End. Take that into account, but there was not much substance here. I saw Andrew Thompson's a report on it, pretty short as well.
I mean, there was, I was glad that like the GCW stuff was asked about, but like his answer was, it was just all about promoting Jericho and Matt Cardona and we promote on independent shows. Like nothing about, the fact that we pulled another talent from these. Anyway, that maybe is our chapter on the ROH media call, but we are going to start front and center with this story that came out today, courtesy of Katie Strang and Andrew Marchand at The Athletic as part of the New York Times, and the headline. I mean, what would a WWE representative see as they wake up this morning, grab their coffee, and the headline is, Lee Fitting was ESPN's golden boy. Then his alleged misconduct finally caught up to him. And what we got is a very lengthy piece on kind of the culture at ESPN and Lee Fitting being a central culprit that is alleged to have contributed to this culture. And when his exit from ESPN went down in August of 2023, this was a week before college football was about to begin for the season. And Lee Fitting was the person overseeing both college and NFL properties for ESPN, a major name at ESPN that caught a lot off guard. Like, why is he being let go? There has to be more to this story. And like there were whispers out there, but nothing concrete until we got this pretty lengthy piece that did include a probe into the culture at ESPN and Lee Fitting being a name that reportedly came up among many people.
And just for some background on this story. So he left ESPN in around August 2023, as you mentioned, just before the college football season was going to start. And so that was very surprising. And I remember on our favorite podcast, which is no longer around, Marshan and O'Ran podcast, which was, around at the time with Andrew Marshan, who is one of the reporters here for The Athletic, and John O'Ran, who's now with Puck. There was,
do you want to hear this?
Marshan. Oh, do you have it ready? Go ahead and play it.
This is from August of 2023, right after Lee Fitting had left ESPN.
Number one is, so we do this podcast and, we do it sometimes quickly after news happens. And so we hear things and there's rumors and this. So we're not going to get into any of those things. The one thing I will say is that you hit on it 5 days before football season began. The fact is he, Lee Fitting, in terms of this reorganization by Jimmy Pitaro and Burke Magnus, he was put under Norby Williamson. Williamson, is like, he'll be the last survivor when ESPN doesn't exist anymore. So he may not retire for like 30 years, but Lee Fitting was put in a position where he was the heir apparent to Norby's kingdom. When you look at all those things and just the unexpected nature of it and the terseness that you mentioned in Williamson's memo to staff, something happened, right? And that's as far as I'll go on this podcast, but something happened where it's, where he was just let go.
And worth noting, Norby Williamson, identified as who will be the last survivor at ESPN, exits ESPN after 4 decades this past April.
Right. And so they're alluding to something there. Andrew Marchand is alluding to some issue that led to his termination at ESPN.
And without going into any further detail than what you just heard there.
Right. And then in January, we got this article from, also from Katie Strang from, The Athletic, reporting on this Emmy scandal, that happened where for College Game Day, which was this very successful, is this very successful show that Lee Fitting was the head production person for. They were submitting these extra names to get extra, Emmy trophies, basically. And so maybe that was the whole story there. But as we learned, there was more to it, reported by The Athletic this morning.
Yeah. And I mean, you and I did some digging into this as well. Like we heard, at least from one person, like off the record, like it was, essentially we had the same questions as anyone.
We were asking around at the time in January. So he was hired by WWE in January. And that's around the same time that this fake Emmys story came out.
Yeah, and why don't you put out the timeline? Because January, there's a lot there in WWE. This preceded the Janelle Grant lawsuit, and this is one of those hirings that it got a lot of attention in sports media. I don't know at the time if it was as much of a focus within pro wrestling, even though in this year that he's been there, you can see the amount of significance that Lee Fitting holds, and now in a total departure from the norm. Like his name prominently featured at the end of these broadcasts on Mondays and Fridays and Tuesdays for that matter.
So he's let go from ESPN in the summer of 2023. He's out of work for a few months. He gets hired by WWE. We can see this article reporting on his hiring by WWE on January 9th.
This is about 2 weeks before the Netflix deal and subsequently the Janelle Grant lawsuit, which is 2 days after the Netflix.
That's all January 25th, 26th, 27th. Vince resigns. Royal Rumble happens. That's at the very end of the month. I think what's important to bring into this context is, Nick Khan has hired a lot of people from the sports media world, including Lee Fitting. I believe he formerly represented Tom Rinaldi, who used to work for College Game Day. So clearly, this is a world that Nick Khan is very connected to and probably had a connection with Lee Fitting and brought him into head production as Kevin Dunn was leaving. We don't know if there were any extra circumstances that surrounded Kevin Dunn's essentially retirement from WWE as he left WWE at the very end of 2023. So basically, Lee Fitting is the person who has taken over many of Kevin Dunn's responsibilities. He's leading production. People have been, enjoying the production and long shots and things like that. That these are things that we think of Lee Fitting as being responsible for, partly if not largely. So he's the one behind. He's the one presumably leading things in the production truck these days.
Yeah, and I would say gained more of a spotlight just within the wrestling circles at one of the WrestleMania press conferences after where Paul Levesque singled out Lee Fitting. And I think that was the first time, like, it is pretty foreign for WWE to kind of name drop in those settings behind the scenes people. And it really did. And then you have the introduction of the end credits. Like, you can see the amount of power and influence Lee Fitting has acquired in this very short time with the company. So it's a very lengthy read. I encourage those that do have access to The Athletic to check out the whole piece by Katie Strang and Andrew Marchand. But we have sort of dialed it down here to some of the key points that are brought up here. So a memo is sent out at ESPN on August 21st of 2023, simply stating that Lee Fitting was no longer with the company. And as we had mentioned, he oversaw College Game Day, which he had done for 19 years and had since been given all college and NFL properties to oversee. One woman that Katie Strang and Andrew Marchand spoke with said, without her name being revealed, "I can't believe it took this long." And it stated in the article, quote, "She and others had watched Fitting rise within ESPN, despite, according to them, making comments objectifying women, criticizing their physical appearance, and making crude jokes, some sexual in nature, in the workplace. This went on unchecked for years, according to the scores of current and former ESPN employees interviewed by The Athletic, who requested anonymity to speak freely because they still work in sports media. Fitting, via a spokesperson, denied some of the allegations made against him while choosing not to address others. He declined to comment on the broader characterization of him as someone who mistreated women during his tenure at ESPN or why he was let go by the network. In 2023, a complaint was filed to Human Resources, and it says that many women who worked on College Game Day and under Fitting elsewhere at ESPN, The Athletic states it spoke to more than 20, including six who participated in the network's 2023 investigation into Fitting, said that the workplace culture under Fitting featured boorish behavior and offensive remarks, many of them sexual in nature. Some examples of this included in 2012, some ESPN employees were watching the NCAA men's basketball tournament from a conference room in Bristol when Fitting allegedly commented on a woman who was not present and didn't work at ESPN and her ability to, quote, open her throat to down a beer, then joked that the woman would be good at performing fellatio, according to one person present. It then says that Fitting, via his spokesperson, said this incident never happened. There's another incident of a production meeting around 2014. No chairs were available for a woman on staff. Fitting patted his lap and said to her, "I've got a seat right here for you," according to one person in the room and another who was told about the remark from another individual present. Fitting denied this allegation. There's more of these accounts from people that The Athletic spoke to. I guess it is important to note he is not accused of at least doing anything physical to women. It sounds like a lot of this was crude jokes, inappropriate language in the workplace. But also it does paint a broader picture, and this is not minimizing any of this, but it does paint this picture of, you know, women that were essentially unable to check this individual because, you know, he is overseeing them. He is in a major role, and these women essentially had to either come up with ways to create defense mechanisms to offset the remarks or just go along with the remarks. And this would run rampant. And if you have ever seen a James Andrew Miller and Tom Shales book on ESPN, like, it goes heavily into this very sexualized culture that is not independent to ESPN. I mean, this is a much broader picture of what a lot of newsrooms, I'm sure, would co-sign off of environments that were fostered. And I don't think that comes as any surprise to people.
Yeah, I mean, that is the stereotype and reputation of sports media newsrooms. I think, you know, it raises a lot of questions about, you look at WWE also hired Jamie Horowitz after he was let go from Fox Sports, from Fox, because of sexual harassment allegations. And to be clear here, the misconduct that is alleged against Lee Fitting is described as what amounts to sexual harassment. This does not minimize what's alleged, but there aren't allegations here of sexual assault. I mentioned that because there is sexual assault alleged against Vince McMahon, against John Laurinaitis in that lawsuit raised by Janelle Grant. But it raises questions about, you know, this is now Nick Khan, who's hired Jamie Horowitz, who is no longer with WWE, but hired Jamie Horowitz after he was let go from a former employer in sports media for sexual harassment allegations. Nick Khan volunteered himself in interviews with Bill Simmons that he did go and meet with Vince during his first resignation time to, you know, stay in touch with him. He did, you know, Nick Khan did, write along with the board that they didn't want him to come back to WWE. Then he came back to WWE. Some members resigned, some members stayed, including Nick Khan and Paul Levesque. They voted unanimously, those remaining voted unanimously to make Vince McMahon the chairman of the board after he added himself to the board unilaterally. He did all that. And then now he's hired, Lee Fitting. I think the question should be raised. And I've asked the question to WWE this morning. Did they know, of this reputation of Lee Fitting before they hired him? Did they try to find out? Did they look into and investigate what did lead to his very abrupt, separation from ESPN? That at least Andrew Marchand was aware that there was something amiss, with his sudden termination. You would probably realize that on its face based on the timing of it right before the college football season began. So what did WWE know before they hired him? Or is there just sort of an indifference and complacency that of not taking these issues very seriously at a time at which in January of 2024, the Grant lawsuit has not been filed yet. That's a few weeks away. Nonetheless, you've just been through about a year and a half of board investigations of your culture, of Vince McMahon's conduct, of John Laurinaitis' conduct. You would think you'd be vigilant about that.
I would think that with WWE, I'm not going to say like just flippantly, they don't care. I think though it would be question number one is if you are sitting down with Lee Fitting for a position like this, it is not so much of take us through every sordid detail, but essentially what is the reason you left ESPN? It is not to say it is disqualifying for you to work here, but what we don't want is an article like this to drop and catching us off guard. We do not want surprises and have to be put into a potential line of fire that we cannot prepare for or that we do not know of. And that to me would be the larger issue if you were WWE, is the idea of not so much the infractions he is accused of, but rather if he was not upfront about this so that today no one is waking up to a surprise. I have a real hard time imagining that these whispers did not make their way over to WWE and people in like a person, the level of connection that Nick Khan holds in this industry, that at least whispers of this did not make his way there. And to me would have been the first thing you're discussing with him to avoid such an appearance that you're caught off guard, like something like this.
Especially if you're hiring somebody into such a high profile job within your company. And as
which,
you mentioned,
which as well, we should mention, like Lee Fitting, definitely a much more, I wouldn't say he has a public profile in WWE, but his name is splashed on their television and he has been singled out by Paul Levesque in media settings. Mm-hmm. Like Jamie Horowitz, he was hired and those 2 years, I mean, you can probably count on your hand the amount of mentions that Jamie Horowitz and that hiring received in terms of any level of scrutiny. And there is
Real quick, Jamie Horowitz's title was executive vice president.
This was a major role.
Which is a high-ranking title in WWE.
But it did not...
Executive vice president of development and digital.
It did not cause this outcry when he was hired. And I think there is a much greater distance when it comes to these names that are not holding like public-facing roles with your company that, I mean, the WWE has not had a shyness when it comes to, you know, what is the value of someone versus what is this excess baggage that accompanies them? And I think that is a way we do need to talk honestly about these types of stories. And this is not a what is fair and not fair. If this were a rank and file performer on the roster that something like comes up, they're just gone quietly. Like an Odyssey Jones just disappears and we never hear from him again. We don't know what the story is with Odyssey Jones, but it was enough that they cut bait and we have never seen him since. And it is worth looking at. Like this is weighted on what is your value and therefore what is our risk level versus PR that we are willing to sustain because your value outweighs your risk. And that is just... That is
it's
the realistic
when your face is on the TV as opposed to, I mean, who's having more of an effect on the television than somebody like Lee Fitting, but his face is not on the TV, which is a big difference in terms of perception, I suppose.
Now, could he, like, you look at this and this is a microcosm of what is going on right now with, like, the nomination of Pete Hegseth in, like, we're talking about, government positions that are having these same discussions about what is, considered, like, someone's political capital versus, you know, any kind of moral ethical standard you have for these people in these positions. Lee Fitting is not someone that is serving the public, but it does give you a sense
Lee Fitting probably more qualified for the job that he's working in than for the one that Pete Hegseth is nominated for.
You know, overseeing 3 million government workers. Why not? This is sort of, I just see, like, there are a percentage of people that are not going to be looking at this as disqualifying. And I think you have another percentage of people that are simply exhausted when it comes to just, these kinds of stories, that it sort of just seems to be something that, like, is this going to just be a 2-day story and it moves on? WWE did not respond to comment for this. And to be fair, in this article, like, this is not a WWE story. Like, this is all about his past with ESPN. It mentions the Janelle Grant lawsuit, but this is not tied into, like, a WWE culture that certainly should be under that spotlight when you're facing 2 sex trafficking lawsuits and you have a history with a Jamie Horowitz, and now you have another hiring that has a checkered past when it comes to his ability to occupy a workspace with females.
Yeah, I guess ESPN is obviously a bigger and a more, you know, talked about thing in the culture. It's something that gets a lot more media attention, especially when it comes to mainstream media outlets like The Athletic, which is owned by the New York Times. It's going to cover something from ESPN with a lot more urgency. I mean, no, to be fair, I would say, look, all these allegations are alleged to have occurred while Lee Fitting was working for ESPN. We don't know of any similar allegations happening while he's worked for WWE. So this is about the culture and the conduct that occurred at ESPN. But of course,
do we know what the protocol would be if there were a complaint to be lodged, and what is the mechanism in place? Would they investigate and start their own probe like ESPN would? Like, what is that process? If you were somebody, like, here we have women that don't even work for Lee Fitting anymore, but are in the industry. They do not want to be named here. I think that's very important here, is that when you are working under these people, like, the latitude is, it's going to be there, that you do not want to necessarily single yourself out, rock the boat, because you understand the differential in, like, your power capital versus those above you. And I think that's a relevant question as well. Like, what are the systems in place that will not allow for this type of behavior to a blind eye to be turned to it? Are there those outlets for people that feel that they are in an environment that is not conducive to, you know, traditional norms of what a workplace should be?
I believe there is an anonymous way to submit a complaint at WWE, and I think this is the case for AEW as well. What happens from there is another question. But I think it's maybe for anybody who's skeptical to understand why this would be a big deal. This is not just somebody who was just another employee at ESPN, but somebody who was overseeing a lot of people and had a lot of power and controlled a lot of the levers to whether somebody was going to move up the chain. And that's the big factor here, and a factor in numerous other cases of sexual misconduct, including in the allegations, which are very different against Vince McMahon and obviously the control and the power that he had as the CEO of the company. It's an issue of, you know, being, you know, making people feel uncomfortable and making people feel like they can't say anything, because the person who is allegedly in the wrong here is the person with a lot of power.
Any other thoughts, takeaways you came out from reading this article? I mean, I'm certain that this was probably many months in the works in terms of the reporting here. And if anything, it was like the number of people they spoke with, like 20 women that they spoke with. I mean, they really did. It does give you a sense, like, this was not some, like, it tells you that, and again, like, I don't think this is a specific Jamie Horowitz, you can add him, but Lee Fitting either, in that, like, these types of comments and jokes, I guarantee you that if you go through many newsrooms, sports, or like many different workplace environments, this stuff is more the norm than the outlier that I think you would find of people of a generation that came up and this was the way that women were treated in these workplaces. And it just became stuff that you accepted as part of the culture. And if you can take the joke, then you're considered one of the guys. But this is like the kind of stuff you would have to put up with in these positions if you were a woman.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Yeah, I guess the last thing to add is that WWE's stance on this and reaction to this is and will probably continue to be to not comment on it, to not give it more attention, to not give any statements or you know, to think of this constructively, to not give any kind of reassurances about what they're doing and how they're being vigilant to prevent misconduct that like the kind that is alleged in this report. But I would, you know, point to what you brought up earlier that, you know, think about our reaction to WrestleMania. One of our big takeaways from WrestleMania was not that the story Cody Rhodes was finished, but that there was a lot of subtle messaging in a positive way about this is not Vince McMahon's company anymore. This is the Paul Levesque company. Nick Khan was brought out there in a sort of a cameo appearance at the end of WrestleMania. Bruce Pritchard brought out there. Paul Levesque at the press conference mentioned Lee Fitting. Chris LaGentle was at the press conference for a moment at the very beginning, sort of to sprinkle all these new faces to say that these are the new leaders of WWE. And this is not the Vince McMahon company with all the Vince McMahon problems anymore. But there is this one of these names that you've mentioned here does have this troubling history. And it undermines the sincerity of that.
Well, we will see. We will see if Paul Levesque speaks on the settle. Maybe this will come up today at the big open house at WWE headquarters, which they wisely are starting at 2 p.m. Eastern time. They did not want to go head to head with Pollock and Thurston. They need to listen. Let's not cannibalize our audience.
We appreciate that.
But what a lead in we've provided them here.
Yes.
Let's shift back to Saturday night. WWE made its long anticipated return to NBC. All those people longing for the days of August of 2008 when they drew 2.5 million viewers on NBC. What would the return to network television after, after 3 months away from regular network programming on Friday nights, with due respect to CW? So Saturday night from the Nassau Coliseum on Long Island, New York, they came out with what was essentially built up as a 2 week build to a premium live event and, you know, a pretty substantial main event in Cody Rhodes and Kevin Owens. And last week, Brandon, you threw out the question of what this would draw on NBC. I certainly thought it would be above this figure. It was 1,590,000 viewers on linear television on Saturday night. This was a night where they did not have extensive competition when it came to college football. They were up against a Heisman Trophy presentation on ESPN. I mean, had I known, I would have changed my Saturday night plans to see.
They were against the NBA Cup game between
the NBA Cup,
Rockets and Thunder on ABC.
I thought this was a disappointing number for a return to NBC, given the level of buildup for this show. To put this into context, if you throw out that best of show last December, this was lower than any SmackDown on Fox during those entire 5 years. This is Saturday night. I understand it is not Friday night, not exactly apples to apples. But I think in the wake of this number, Brandon, it was more so interesting to see how this number was rolled out. And boy, when we talk about will we get streaming numbers, God, was there an instant, hey, look at our streaming numbers to this one that props this number up to a more digestible 2.3 million viewers when we include these 700,000 an NBCU rep did confirm to you. So this is not like coming from WWE, but we did get that streaming number. And so this is the beginning of what will be one of the stories of 2025, and that is trying to separate linear from streaming figures.
I was predicting something around maybe, well, something around what they were doing on at the very end. I guess if you take this Peacock number, which we have to get into, if you take this Peacock number at face value, it's about what I was expecting. Cause I was looking back on what the last, what SmackDown was doing at the end. And I was saying, oh, it could do 2.3 million viewers, which would be actually in line with the very last Saturday Night's Main Event of the previous series, less memorable series of Saturday Night's Main Events, which was in 2008, where they did 2.35 million viewers for right. the last episode in 2008. So they did 1.59 million viewers on NBC. Of course, this was broadcast on Peacock as well. We had Jimmy Traina, though, tweeting on Sunday that he's hearing that the Saturday Night's Main Event broadcast, which ran head-to-head with the NBA Cup game on ABC, actually beat the ABC NBA game.
In head-to-head viewers.
In head-to-head viewers.
He did make that qualifier.
And we can dissect that.
Jimmy Traina found himself in the line of fire after this tweet.
So well, that was, he didn't say, you know, not only did he not say where he got that information from, but he did not say that it had to have been Fast Nationals. There's no final ratings on Saturday ratings until Tuesday morning. So anyway, we get the final ratings. I got the final ratings on Tuesday morning for the Saturday viewership, and we see that the NBA semifinal game on ABC averaged 1.89 million viewers, and it did a 4.7.
Is that higher or lower than 1.590?
I'm going to have to get out the calculator here. It also did a 0.47 in the demo. Now, what NBC did with Saturday Night's Main Event from 8 to 10 is 1.59. So that's some 300,000 viewers less and five demo ratings points higher than NBC. So, yes. The ABC broadcast of the NBA game beat the NBC broadcast of the NBA game. But wait, it was also on Peacock. It was also on Peacock, where it was watched by an additional 700,000 somethings, 700,000 maybe viewers. I'm trying to confirm whether this is 700,000 accounts, whether this is 700,000 viewers. And here's where the message, lucky for WWE and NBC, will get lost. How is this being measured?
Is this the average? Is this the peak?
Right.
What was the average watch time? Like that, that's with streaming. It's just not an apples to apples comparison as it is to, you know, what we know is the methodology behind Nielsen tracking linear broadcast. And so it's like, I go back to the Logan Paul or Jake Paul, Mike Tyson fight. And it's like, I was constantly logging in and I was on multiple systems, but if I'm just tuning in for 10 minutes and I'm out, like, are they averaging out? You just don't know what this 700,000 is. And the fact that this is also not being monitored by an independent party either. So
now this could have been Nielsen data. I just don't know. This might have been Nielsen data. Nielsen does cover, you know, how many people are how many people are using Peacock in a given amount of time. They do cover that. Now, they're probably not covering Saturday Night's Main Event on Peacock, but they are covering it for NBC. But I think it's important to get across, you know, on NBC, 1.59 million viewers watched. That is a measurement of not how many people watched a minute of it or 5 minutes of it. That's an average on the average minute across that 120-minute broadcast. On average, across that 2 hours, 1.59 million viewers were watching Saturday Night's Main Event. This Peacock number, maybe that's what it means. And I followed up, I asked NBCU, is this a reflection of the number of, now this could be accounts that logged in. This could be the number of accounts that logged into the stream and watched some part of it. Or this could be an average minute audience measurement, which would be like to like with what the NBC number is that we have, but we don't know. Now, if this is the number of accounts, well then, there is necessarily more than one person on average per account watching, because you've got at least one person watching on each account. And then presumably you've got, in some cases, more than one person watching on each account. So it's so you could multiply that number by, you know, whatever it is, the number of accounts watching by 1 point something or 2 point something, and you get a larger number, obviously, but we just don't know. And as I wrote an update to this on my report of the TV rating for Saturday Night's Main Event, this is, perhaps just a preview of what will begin to be routine 2 weeks from now when it's the new year, when Raw is not airing on USA Network, but is airing on Netflix, when AEW Dynamite, AEW Collision are airing not just on TBS and TNT, but also on Max. And I don't know if Nielsen is going to cover those programs and provide us with third-party data that is not coming from the network or from the wrestling company, but third-party data that, you know, is theoretically disinterested in the outcome here, and it wants to provide a unbiased measurement for advertisers and others to understand, and most importantly, wrestling fans to understand how many people are watching this in a way that we can compare it to other measurements of a similar kind. So it's going to be really, it's a fraught future, I fear, that we're about to go into here. A lot of people are worried about what the new year will bring for a number of reasons. Another reason to add to your anxiety is that I don't know what's going to happen to TV ratings, and we might have, you know, it's an opportunity for a lot of sleight of hand and for people to get misled about what exactly the measurement of these audiences are. And in AEW's case, I assume that their TBS and TNT viewership is going to be cannibalized to some degree. It also gives WBD and AEW an opportunity to, you know, tell people that this is the number of people though who are watching on Max. And is that going to be a like-to-like comparison to, what's, you know, to how the TBS or TNT measurement is, will be an important question. I guess if I'm going to urge anything to wrestling media is that we need to find out whatever numbers they give us about what the streaming audience is. We need to find out if that is being measured in the same way, average minute audience, as the Nielsen data is for the traditional TV broadcast data that we track.
I am sure this is all going to be handled really delicately with great nuance, and people will understand the splintering of the audience into streaming.
And we're all studying.
I expect all of these broadcasters, like, this is the precedent that we will get streaming numbers every week.
They'll be transparent and they'll share with us. They want us to know. They don't want there to be any confusion or doubt, especially if it's not in their favor. They don't want to give anybody an outsized understanding of how well they're doing.
So, I mean, just putting this into context, like, I didn't think this was a great number, but again, when we're looking at the state of broadcast, like, this would have been in comparison to, like, we look at, and Brandon did a great job this past week of culling together all of the viewership figures for Saturday night's main event going back to 1985 that you can see up on the WrestleNomics Patreon, as well as
it's free too.
Oh, it's free too. Look at that. I choose to just give you my money, Brandon. But I mean, you look at the numbers that they were at. Granted, I know this is a totally different generation, but what they were doing in 1991 when NBC punted on the Saturday night's main event concept. And then in 1992, like, their last broadcast on Fox with Bret Hart and Papa Shango is doing 14.3 million viewers. And Fox was like, that's it for us. I mean, the broadcast landscape has changed so much that with 1.6 million viewers, this was still third for the night on all of television in 18 to 49. Do you think that this is a number that is that you're happy with if you are NBC? And just in terms of this was really presented as it's WWE's return to NBC. The business is on fire. You have, you know, several references on the broadcast. Wrestling is bigger than ever. I mean, are there any takeaways you had regarding that? Because I just looked at this as, you know, a understanding of, like, how many people were interested in an excess, like, really a premium live event on free television on a Saturday night. And it was about the audience that watches a typical Raw or SmackDown these days.
Right. If you're talking about expectations, I would say it was, if you take the Peacock number at its face value, it's about what I expected. But that said, it's only slightly larger on NBC than it was than SmackDown or Raw did in the surrounding weeks. It's very similar. Now to add incremental value, I think it just has to be better than whatever would have aired in its place. And I did look at that the other week and I saw that, yeah, this is probably going to easily do, you know, better than a 0.20 or something like that, which is about what it would need to do to be better than, in the demo in particular, to be better than the viewership that would be in its place otherwise. So I would say it's probably disappointing based on expectations. If you're NBC though, it's probably giving you an added value, and for WWE to try to, you know, extend its reach a little bit more and to get more eyeballs in front of WWE content, it'll do that. just by virtue of being on more platforms, being on higher reach NBC, being on Peacock for another night. It's doing that. And that's part of what, and I have heard some confusion. This is a quarterly deal. This is not, there's going to be another one in San Antonio in, do you know,
January 25th is the next date. And it's the night before the NFL conference championship game. So it's not like there's any NFL on that particular night. And it's the week before the Royal Rumble.
And they're very, very thoughtful with their placement of these dates. Nick Khan is following that sports calendar, and he's picking the right dates where there's an opening. So there's going to be four of these every year. This is not a case of like NBC deciding they like WB so much, which I'm sure they do, but it's not a case of them liking WB so much that they're going to add. This is part of the deal for a year. But it'll be another night to watch more wrestling content, which, the big difference between the era is not only in terms of television just being radically different than it is today in many ways, but in the era of Saturday Night's Main Event, you know, in the 80s and 90s, weekly TV was mostly jobber matches. And this was like pay-per-views, like the house show business, an opportunity to actually see the stars versus the stars. And yeah, this was a big built-up match between Kevin Owens and Cody Rhodes. But you see the stars versus the stars every single week on Raw and SmackDown.
Yes. And while he is, he was not present for this past Saturday Night's Main Event, the next one in January, the promo that they have put out, it is all centered around Hulk Hogan, who does a voiceover for it. So one would assume that the next broadcast on NBC will be heavily focused on Hulk Hogan and that nostalgia. Where was Hulk Hogan on Saturday night, you ask? Well, instead, he was lending his name to another TKO property, walking out with the American flag alongside Colby Covington for his fight where he was destroyed by Joaquin Buckley. Colby Covington, of course, in the news, if you missed it last week, referring to Palestinian fighter Bilal Muhammad as a terrorist. And that's who Hulk Hogan lent his endorsement to on Saturday night.
Well, Hulk Hogan has a lot of experience with promoting American nationalism. So you can see how that would fit.
All right. I do encourage people to check out the Saturday Night's Main Event numbers. And also, I mean, commented on the broadcast for the longest time. Then the figure attached to that February 1988 match between Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant was listed at 33 million viewers. But part of that, I think, was the viewers per home was kind of, the estimate was off, but now we have a clear audience figure attached to Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant and what they drew in February of 1988. And the number for the record books is 26.6 million.
I thought it was 33 million, right?
Well, that is the number you would have heard on the broadcast. And listen, that was the number.
Did they say 33 million on the broadcast?
Michael Cole did say 33 million on the broadcast on Saturday. Yes. He, you know, he might have let his WrestleNomics subscription lapse this month. So, but it was a free post. But listen, that had been a number that had been attached to this for so long.
So the real average, and this is one of those things where, you know, it's wrestling and it's, people are going to freak out. And then they haven't yet. I haven't seen any of that, but you know, especially given the similarity of it's a Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant match. And that's the WrestleMania 3 match. And there's been decades of unresolved controversy surrounding the attendance of that. You're trying to undermine that. In any case, this is the largest, regardless of what it is, whether it's 26 million, whether it's 33 million, which it's not. It is the biggest wrestling audience probably ever. We don't have numbers. I don't have any numbers going back to see what kind of numbers Vern Gagne was drawing on the Dumont network. But given the lower population, I'm guessing it was not approaching 26 million. So this is the biggest audience that has ever tuned in the United States. Maybe people were crowding around the department stores in Ricky Dozan's era watching him fight the Destroyer. I don't know. But in the United States, there has never been a larger audience in all likelihood watching a wrestling show than that February 5th, 1988, Friday night main evented by Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant. And underneath that was the Honky Tonk Man and Randy Savage. So for years, It has been believed that it was 33 million viewers. That was based on the correct household number, which was estimated and just assumes to, it was just assumed that about 2.4 people were watching per household, which I think is short of a, is sort of a shorthand assumption that people would make about TV ratings, because we had the household numbers, which were probably more readily being reported at the time. So you just took that number and multiplied it by 2.4 and assumed that was the number of viewers who were watching. And that's what got repeated contemporaneously in a number of newspapers. And I can find this being reported and repeated throughout a number of newspaper publications at the time in 1988. If you go back and look at newspapers.com, which I'm big, growing into a big fan of newspapers.com, I digress. But if you look at, I have it right here, but we have, guess what we have? Thanks to Corey Gibson and the great research he's been doing for years now, really. We have not just somebody saying it in a newspaper, not just somebody saying it in a wrestling newsletter. We have the Nielsen data. What's called the Nielsen pocket pieces, which,
you know, when Brandon goes on vacation, this is his beach reading right here.
Yes. Which is at the time, let's dig into this. At the time in 1988, there was no internet. There were no mobile phones. There were no smartphones. There was no Nielsen portal. You had to have a Nielsen pocket piece, which was this, transportable book that would tell you what the ratings were. And, you have to do some math to actually figure out what the total viewership number is here. But suffice to say, this tells us exactly what, I'll show you here's the line for those watching in video where it explains, this was this many households were watching this show and this many, people per 1,000 viewing households. If you want to see the math, go to the article, were watching this show. And it even gives us not quarter hours, but half hours, and we could do the math on how many people were watching that last half hour, which was mostly the Hogan and Andre match. It's about 28 million were watching that last half hour on average. So did it get up to
33
million?
Is there a chance of 5 million people were streaming this?
No. In fact, there were no people streaming it. I can guarantee you that.
Okay.
No. Nobody had the internet. There were no streaming devices.
What about closed circuit? Was this on closed circuit?
I don't think there was any closed circuit for this. Did it get up to 33 million for the match, for at any minute for the match itself? I don't know, but I doubt it. I doubt it grew that much. You know, it did go from 26 million on average throughout a 60 minute period. It grew up to 28 million and change, for that last half hour. Maybe it got up to 30 million. I don't know if it got up to 33 million. But I mean, look, this is the biggest audience ever. This is an incredible number.
It's an incredible amount of people that were tuning in on a Friday night. This wasn't even the Saturday night time slot that people were kind of accustomed to, for the main event.
And I went through, just put that in some perspective for people. The most watched NFL game so far this year, at least in primetime, and I think this is throughout the season, is 26 million viewers for the Thanksgiving evening telecast of the Packers and somebody. That is the most watched NFL broadcast. That's how many people were watching Hogan and Andre. A little more than that, if you look at the last half hour. That's how many people were watching Hogan and Andre at a time where there were 100 million fewer people in this U.S. population. Different time, different era of television completely. Far fewer channels, far fewer options. But that's what happened.
All right. I'm going to segue into the Canadian Media Minute. Okay. So here's what is going on in Canadian media as it regards professional wrestling. I mean, this would drive you nuts, Brandon, if you had to decipher the amount of explaining that we're going to have to do in the new year. AEW Collision is moving to the USA Network.
Uh-oh.
In Canada. So Bell Media.
I know you had USA Network.
We didn't either. It's being, the Discovery Channel is being rebranded as of January 1st into the USA Network. In Canada, I really hope that we can launch a Canadian network for you guys down there, and we can include, Hockey Night in Canada and whatever other exports that we have. Maybe some more reruns of Schitt's Creek. But yes, why is this important?
Is this a shot being fired back at WB broadcasting on TNT Sports in the UK?
This is a long term play by AEW to get onto the USA Network. And, I mean, for me, selfishly, as I'm going to watch all these Canadian shows move to Netflix, I mean, my Canadian ratings, Brandon. I need to have Canadian shows to get numbers for, and it looks like I might get collision numbers. So this will go into effect in January. Right now, if you're in Canada, AEW Collision and Rampage are only available on TSN Plus, which is a streaming service that you have to subscribe to. It does not come with your TSN package. So that is why Dynamite is, I would imagine, most people's AEW viewing. And I don't know anyone that is following Collision that is watching it on TSN Plus. It's, I think, going by creative outlets to go track down Collision and Rampage if you are seeking them out. But you will get it on actual linear television beginning in January. So it's a step up from the current distribution method. And also worth noting, Rampage not part of this deal. So I think your latest nail in the coffin of Rampage.
So this is a rebranding. This blows my mind. This is an NBCU brand that's of a WBD channel. I'm not going to try to understand this. Do people have this channel in Canada?
It's a specialty channel. I don't know what the amount of homes it's in.
You get
I don't even know if I get it, to be quite honest. But I'll tell you 100% I don't get TSN Plus. I have a pretty good chance I have this. This is not going to change my viewing. I use Triller, and it's tremendous for following AEW programming. But that is what's happening. Also, this was first reported by Dave Meltzer. I confirmed this with WWE. They confirmed this on the record to me that SmackDown on January the 3rd, all Canadians were like, what are we going to do about SmackDown? On January 3rd, it will air on YouTube in Canada. And then the Netflix era begins on January the 6th. And that
for everybody, everybody starting on one date, there will be no mixed messaging.
No. So everyone can congregate on YouTube. We can get live viewing numbers in real time and decipher them there for all Canadians. Let us look at the final week of WWE house shows, which it's worth noting that for 2025, at least for they have rolled out like the first 3 months, there are no U.S. house shows announced for the first 3 months of 2025. There are no U.S. dates on the books right now. Am I mistaken? Is this correct?
I don't know. You were
pondering. Sure.
I don't doubt you. So we have coming up as far as house shows that are announced is at least as I look in the Russell Ticks spreadsheet here, he's only got the house shows for the rest of the year, which are WWE live events, holiday shows across great markets like Jacksonville, New York, Pittsburgh, Orlando, which is going head to head. On the same night, is it the same day as AEW? I don't know. In any case, Orlando as well as, Baltimore, Maryland is what looks to be the last one. There are two house shows going on at the same night on December 28th, Saturday in both Orlando and Baltimore.
How do I sound now?
You sound great now.
Oh, thank God. I just found these to be interesting because, I mean, these are, you know, these are fine advances. But I would look at, you know, the Allstate Arena in Chicago is currently around 6,500. These are all courtesy of WrestleTix. The Kaseya Center in Miami is at 3,300, tickets distributed.
Oh, wow.
These are traditionally big house shows. The company has been doing really well. And like you've monitored sort of a bit of a plateauing when it comes to advances. TVs. Yeah, ticket prices as well. It just seems like this is the first time I'm looking at things, and there does seem to be a feel of, you know, for live events, which are very match heavy. It doesn't seem as though like these are, you know, it's not like these are the hot ticket that maybe we would have assumed when these dates were first announced. Like even Madison Square Garden it's going to surpass 10,000. Like these are certainly not disappointments. But some of these numbers, like Miami especially, like 3,300. That'll grow a little bit over the next 2 weeks, but it's just an interesting. I think a couple factors. I think ticket prices are something that people are noting, and I think a lot of this current boom, like they are very much attracted to these stars and television, and I don't know if there's like this broad appeal for just going to see, you know, a live event that is seen as maybe less consequential, but maybe I'm looking too deep.
Their house show attendance has been up though at the same time that they're on and SmackDown attendance has been up. I think they were averaging something around 6,000 tickets distributed according to Russell Tix's numbers. for the year. I'll look that up real quick. They were averaging over 5,000, 5,900 for this year to date. 5,700 the year prior, 4,000. Now we're going back to 2022, 4,100 for 2022. So that's increased at looks to be a similar rate to the Raw and SmackDown attendances.
Yes. And, as I'm just looking here at the, well, for early 2025, all we have to look at is, television dates here for WWE. And these are, I mean, they're over 11,000 for that Intuit Dome launch of Raw on Netflix. And then, yeah, San Jose, Dallas, Atlanta are the next, Raw taping. So, something to monitor potentially, where things are. Cause I'd say for that Netflix show, I mean, so much of the appeal of it, I think, is as a broadcast to be watching, much less than necessarily going there in person. But that's going to obviously be a big show. I feel we will get streaming numbers for January 6th. That's my prediction.
I'm sure there'll be some sort of celebration and press release.
Graphics.
Will there be a number? I mean, there's no Nielsen to muddy the waters here. There's only streaming to muddy the waters. I guess. I don't know. The thing is, it's going to be global. And the thing is here too, I always, I remember that this is the case, that Netflix does publish their top 10 globally, global viewership. And when I've looked at that, that does look like they're putting over on the side there the watch time divided by the duration, which gives you essentially an average minute audience, which would be like to like with Nielsen. But it's global, not United States.
Super chat here. We will revisit the Tony Khan media call. Thank you for the super chat. Tony Khan media call. No questions about Ray Phoenix or his tweets or Ryan Nemeth or Effie. What's the point of these calls? Brandon, you were on this call. I was not able to be part of this call, not because I was not invited. I had to actually go pick up my kids from school. So I was not on this call. You were. Did you get a question in?
No, my hand was up. I would say if you're going to criticize the media broadly in one whole sentence as one whole package, especially when it comes to these press conferences in terms of not getting the questions asked that you think are right to be asked, a lot of that goes on the company. It's not all on the members of the media. A lot of it goes to the company and who they allow to ask a question. My hand was up. I was not chosen. I was chosen on the previous call to ask a question, but I've been on a lot of calls, especially in the last year or so, where I've not been chosen to ask a question, despite my virtual hand being raised. So the companies get to pick and choose who gets to answer a question, gets to ask a question, and not 100% of that burden is left to the media, the wrestling media.
Yeah, we don't all get together and just plot out all these things, but I do understand some people it's easier to simplify, but that is kind of how the process works. Okay. This next question I'm going to put on. I'm aware of this, but I don't know how much we can necessarily go into it because it's kind of just come out today. Did you see the Chris Peck, BJ Whitmer AEW situation? BJ Whitmer's ex-wife put out a post alleging inhumane actions from Chris Peck of AEW. So, I have not had a chance to really go into this yet. So given the nature of like, obviously this is a very serious story. I just can't comment because I haven't had a chance to go through it yet, but I'm sure we will have something up on the site in the, either today or tomorrow, going over this because I have seen it.
We have received DMs about it since we've been on the air, but I can't read about it to speak to it. Just to be clear about who Chris Peck is. He is the general counsel for AEW.
Thank you for the super chat, and I'm sure we will have a story coming up shortly. Jake from the Windy City, who would you say are the top merch sellers in 2024 in WWE? Cody, in all likelihood, seems to be number one. Does the perception mesh with reality?
Yes. So WWE itself said who they were last month. I've got the article right here. Cody Rhodes, they said, was number one. Well, they said. They put images in an order that strongly suggested these are the top 10 talent who are moving merchandise. And they said it's Cody Rhodes, number one, Roman Reigns, number two. This is the exact same number one and number two of last year, too. They did a very similar graphic, followed by CM Punk, Jey Uso, John Cena, Liv Morgan, Rhea Ripley, LA Knight, Randy Orton, Damian Priest. My daily collection of where the items stand and trying to put those items assigned to various wrestlers was in line with that. I had, based on that information, Jey Uso number one, CM Punk, but then Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns number three and four. I also had Stone Cold Steve Austin and Bray Wyatt, highly ranked in that too. They have not included the stars of the past who are inactive, on these lists, it looks like. So maybe they just don't rank, and maybe there's venue merchandise considered in here too. That's making it different from my lists as well. But I believe that's probably correct, that these are the number one and number two movers of merchandise, Cody and Roman.
Final topic, Brandon, as we put a bow on 2024, what do you feel at year's end were the most significant stories of 2024, and how many of them occurred in January?
Yeah, I guess it was the General Grant lawsuit is something that's occupied a lot of our time. I would say AEW renewing their deal, finally finalizing their deal this past October.
I mean, for just like, you know, obviously like very different story from the Janelle Grant story, but that's like, I feel like there is just so much discussion on AEW, but like that is a massive win that they got this, this renewal. I think it's like, it's rather remarkable in some ways, like just to be able to have this cushion for 3 years. AEW is not without its issues, but there is certainly, more runway now to address those issues than if, say, they were going into this contract year coming up, as opposed to now having these negotiations in the rear view.
They likely have their financial future secured for at least a couple of years. And that's a really good thing for the wrestling industry, for there to be a viable number two wrestling company. As I say every time we bring this up, the notion that this would be a possibility some 6 years ago, that you would have a number two non-WWE wrestling product on major TV networks, was just laughable. Get out of here with that. Yeah, go watch Lucha Underground on El Rey. Yeah, but that has really happened, and it's a good thing, well, for wrestling fans and for talent and for all workers of all kinds in wrestling, that they've got another wrestling company that will value their skills and that might bid a little more aggressively for their skills because of that. And that makes for, you know, optionality and alternatives should make for a more fair wrestling product, even though they both still have their issues. But yes, the Janelle Grant lawsuit, just putting in detail what had been very vague and very blurry for the year and a half prior, during which the Vince McMahon scandal and the various allegations of misconduct and NDAs were known about. But you could think, well, maybe it just sort of amounted to sexual harassment or something like that. You know, there was this allegation of forced oral sex, but it wasn't put in detail. There was not a name and a face to put with it until Janelle Grant filed her lawsuit on January 25th this year. And I think that's a big part in one of the biggest wrestling stories, I think, in wrestling history.
Because it goes part and parcel with the resignation of Vince McMahon on top of it, which, I mean, unlike the last resignation, I think it's really hard to imagine any kind of pathway back to WWE for a Vince McMahon.
With the voting power gone, yes. Yeah.
With the voting power gone, and might just be limited to quarterly breakfasts with TKO executives.
He still owns, despite what you heard in the Netflix documentary. And that's right. And WWE has made a number of disclosures recently now, that he still owns just over 8 million shares in TKO. We didn't talk about TKO's stock price, which is apparently doing well. That's a market value of more than $1 billion.
Yeah, this has like just been this quiet ascension of TKO's stock, which Brandon can bring up. It's currently trading, well, it's actually a little under where it was yesterday, but it's $145.78. This stock, to put into context, over the past 6 months has grown 42%, which is an incredible increase. And it seems a lot of it are analysts looking at this next year and these UFC media rights and the position that the UFC is in, which common theme you hear among many different analysts is the fact that so many, like all the major league sports rights are tied up save for the UFC, and they could be in a great position for these broadcast networks and streaming options that have the budget to make a very big pitch for UFC.
Yeah. And they'll, yeah, I think this is, you know, among the synergies and the great industrial logic that is going to benefit WWE and UFC under the TKO umbrella, is that look, they're WWE's going to have a relationship with Netflix. They'll know things about that relationship, including how well the stream works on a weekly basis. And maybe that brings in an easy conversation to start to have about, you know, maybe you'd like some UFC content. And even if they don't get some UFC content, it maybe still helps bring the bids up for ESPN, Disney to retain it.
The marketplace is frothy.
Oh, yeah.
The quote of the year, in my estimation. Some other stories that come to mind. Obviously, I say this as like, is a WWE achievement, but like if we were to look at this Janelle Grant lawsuit and how this company just thrived after it and distanced itself from Vince McMahon and capped off like its most successful WrestleMania, and this did not compromise the Netflix deal, and then they had, you know, so much coverage. Vince McMahon had a six episode series on Netflix. Like, they completely distanced themselves. And I think it's also an understanding of, I think that there is a separation among the public of WWE and Vince McMahon that has been to their benefit. But that was absolutely a strategy that was put into place this year that you cannot deny has been a successful one. They have not skipped a beat in any discernible way.
I don't think it's overstating it to say the Janelle Grant lawsuit has really underrated impact on the wrestling business. Not only, yes, did it lead to Vince McMahon resigning and probably permanently at this point being gone from WWE and TKO, but it also, well, it was already starting to happen. But really, I mean, all of this Vince McMahon scandal is largely because of Janelle Grant, because their NDA, the NDA that they made in January 2022, they made that NDA, and then the Wall Street Journal reported first just the Janelle Grant portion without naming her at that time. And this led to eventually Vince resigning for the first time. Then the lawsuit led to him resigning for the second time. This led to the Vince McMahon being ultimately out of WWE Creative, which led to ultimately, I mean, you can put the perception in there as well, especially if you don't like WWE still, and say, well, they just like it because they think Vince is gone. Whatever. Their business is doing a lot better than it was before when Vince was the head of creative in terms of attendance and TV ratings. And that has ultimately helped WWE's business because of this scandal breaking. And this has also hurt AEW's business because their main competitor, WWE, got a lot stronger. Now, AEW's had issues in addition to that. That are of it, solely of its own making. Let's not get it twisted. But a stronger WWE relieves the reason and the need for an alternative, which is AEW. So all of this just comes out of these allegations coming to light.
It's like the butterfly effect is immense of what that triggered for not just WWE, but to your point, like AEW as well. And again, we can all go back, like the grand question that may never be answered is ultimately a board member that opted to, like, it was very clear that there was some board member that had knowledge of this that decided to get this information out there.
Which is a result of, to get really into the weeds here, which is a result of a so-called friend of Janelle Grant emailing the board.
Right.
That's what makes the board aware of it. And that's where the Vince side believes that she violated the NDA.
Right. Because this friend of Janelle Grant contacts the board. This is March 2022. The first story from the Wall Street Journal comes out in June. Vince is gone in July, back at the end of the year.
Right. Their NDA had been made just weeks or months, a couple months before the board became aware of the NDA.
Fascinating. But those are some of the big stories of this year. Other ones I noted here, I mean, to a lesser degree, I mean, this is more for next year. It's kind of where this ID program grows into, how much of an influence it has on the independent scene. The decrease of WWE live events as well, like making this, and the future of site fees for TKO and where that is kind of a growing area for them as well, that they seem to be targeting very aggressively with UFC and PBR. Could we be getting the first ever triple shot weekend between these three juggernauts of live entertainment?
I suppose. I mean, you're probably drawing three completely different audiences doing it too. If there's an argument to do it, I mean, that's it. Is that there's a UFC fan who is not a WWE fan, who is definitely not a PBR fan across all three of those brands. Yeah.
It's one thing to send your talent to go be in the crowd at a UFC event. It's quite another to send Dominic to the local PBR event.
In the Vince era, you would get a bull riding character that would become who's promising from NXT right now. That would be Ethan Page's gimmick or something when he got called up to the main roster.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap up our final edition of the show for this year. Our return date up in the air. We might end up doing a show the first week of January. We will not be here on New Year's Day, but
we will not be here next week on Christmas Day.
No. As much as we would love to just wake up with all of you and open our presents on a live stream, we're going to take Christmas and New Year's Day off. But there will be plenty to talk about in the new year. And I want to thank everybody that has listened to the show over the past year, whether you tune in live on Wednesdays or listen after the fact. This is a show that I get a lot of great feedback about that people seem to enjoy with myself and Brandon. And I think people seem to tolerate me, and they really get a lot of knowledge out of Brandon. So it's a nice combo.
Yeah. I'm glad. I don't care if anybody likes this or not. We're going to do it. No, but I do appreciate everybody supporting WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling. And we're trying to do, you know, work that is not necessarily popular, but that we think is important. So we appreciate the support that we do have.
All right. On that note, we will say goodbye to everyone and the final words of 2024.
Appreciate the courage.